This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast. And today I'm broadcasting to you from the heart of Europe. In fact, I am in the Alps, a small little guest house costing a measly 13 euros a night with a nice big breakfast, and I can tell you it's as clean as a pin with a great view and a little balcony. And what a great place to get away from it and do some work on my next book, and also some work editing the updates for Jewish Supremacism and for My Awakening that I'm working on at the present time. I can hear the birds chirping outside. We just had a very strong rainstorm. And today, you know, I decided to, going through this book and looking for the updates that I have to do, Jewish Supremacism, I thought about the fact that I'm going to put some of this book, at least the introduction, in a verbal format. Certainly the spoken word is a very powerful format. And so today what I'm going to do is I'm going to start going through the preface, and we'll probably do it in three or four parts, however many times it takes, about 15 to 20 minutes each part. And I think it'll be a great introduction to the Jewish question and a great one to send your friends and family. So let's go ahead and get started. This is going to be part one of the author's preface to Jewish Supremacism. I promise that this book will challenge you. Its amazing documentary evidence will confront some of your most cherished beliefs. If you can put aside, as best you can, the prejudices you may have on this subject and even preconceptions you might have about me personally, you can more fairly evaluate the ideas and evidence in this book. Now that is all an author can ask of his reader, and it's all I ask of you. It is my earnest belief that if you endeavor to keep an open mind, what you read here will surprise you. The real power of this book comes from its documentation from major sources. In fact, you'll quickly discover that most of my documents about Jewish supremacism are from Jewish sources. They argue more convincingly from my point of view than anything I could write. I encourage you to go to the sources that I quote and check them for yourself. In this book, I take you with me on a fascinating journey of discovery in a forbidden subject. I urge you to courageously keep an open mind while you explore the topics ahead. That's the only way any of us can find the truth. Some will defame this book by calling it anti-Semitic. Yet it's not considered anti-American to examine historical mistreatment of American Indians. No one calls it anti-Christian to talk about the excesses of the Inquisition. No one says that it's anti-Muslim to examine extreme elements within Muslim fundamentalism. Is one considered anti-white for documenting the history of Jim Crow in the South? This book is not anti-Semitic. It simply examines and documents the powerful elements of ethnic supremacism that have existed in the Jewish community from historical to modern times. Any criticism of Jewish supremacism is immediately condemned as anti-Semitism. The chronic media recital of the horrors of the Holocaust has made the term anti-Semitic morally equivalent to the endorsement of mass murder. The word itself shuts down reason and evokes heat rather than light. The word is flagrantly overused. It is even used against those who simply protest Israeli human rights violations against Palestinians. I'm reluctant to begin my book by saying what it's not. The media climate, however, forces me to do so. Due to the overwhelming power of the media to distort what I say and write, I state emphatically here and now that I do not oppose all Jews any more than an author examining the excesses of the Inquisition opposes all Christians. Specifically, Jewish supremacism examines a long record of Jewish supremacist ideology and history that has had a powerful and damaging effect on both the Jewish and the Gentile world. I'll be the first to acknowledge that not all Jews support or share in the supremacism. In fact, a number of courageous Jews suffer greatly for opposing it. This book is dedicated to the memory of one of them, an Israeli professor, Dr. Israel Shahak, a former professor at Hebrew University who recently passed away. Dr. Shahak believed that Jewish supremacism has greatly harmed the Palestinian people as well as the non-Jewish community the world over. He offered strong evidence that Jewish radicals have waged an unrelenting ethnic war against Gentiles since the days of their sojourn in Egypt. Dr. Shahak believed that this extreme chauvinism has helped bring about centuries of repeated anti-Semitic reactions, ranging from the pogroms of Pharaoh to the horrors of what is now called the Holocaust. He persuasively argued that unless both Jews and Gentiles courageously stand up against the supremacist agenda and its power, it will continue to pose a severe danger to Jews and Gentiles alike. This book is ultimately about lessening both the dangers and the hatreds between our peoples, and this cannot happen until both Jews and Gentiles hear the other side of the Jewish question, a point of view currently forbidden in the modern world. As I write these lines, I sit on a mountain in the Colorado Rockies, named after the aspen tree, whose shade I now enjoy. Its cylindrical leaves turn easily in the cool breeze, reflecting the sunlight and affording me a magical image. Through those glittering leaves, I can see snow-capped peaks on the horizon. The sight pleases both my eyes and my soul. From this mystic place, I cannot see a single human being. Only the magnificence of nature fills my eyes. Questions of politics, culture, religion, nationalities, ethnicity, and race seem far away from here. From this vantage point, the world and even nature herself appear serene. Yet, when I look closely at the serene beauty of nature, I can see conflict and war that far eclipses even the worst turmoil found in mankind. Here in this mountain, a never-ending struggle rages of element against element and species against species. The wind, rain, and snow will someday level these great mountains of rock. Even the flowing stream, the ultimate symbol of serenity for many people, violently fights for its life of movement against the mountain. Indeed, in time, this great mountain will eventually succumb to even the tiniest rivulets of water and other erosions of nature. As I write in my notebook, two ants approach a peach pit on the rock beside me. One ant is larger and very differently equipped than the other. He has his way over the smaller one, but the vanquished creature runs back to his kingdom to report the great store of sweet food. His relatives will seek to return to the treasure before their competitors. The two tiny breeds might even go to war over the morsel, and my eyes open to the war waged all around me. On this mountain, the trees, the bushes, and grasses compete for the sunlight and for life itself. Smaller birds keep wary eyes out for hawks. The flora and fauna face the danger of death from the insects and parasites seeking to consume them. Even within every life form, a microscopic war rages. The more closely one looks, the more intense the battle. In 1 cubic meter of rich soil, there are more living creatures injured, killed, eaten, or even exploited and enslaved than all the numbers of human beings on Earth who faced a similar fate. Biologists could offer endless examples of the never-ending battle for life and dominance between life forms, enough to fill a million books the size of this one. Yet oddly, it is this brutal struggle of survival waged over billions of years that produced the serene beauty that so touches my heart as I look out from this high place. So perhaps this mountain is not so unlike the eternal battles among humankind. The historical struggle between human races has played a powerful role in our human evolution, just as it has for all life forms throughout the natural world. Its result for humanity is no less breathtaking than the view from this mountain. It produced a higher humanity that has given us the art of Da Vinci's Madonna and Child, the ultimate expressions of sublime love found in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, or Keats' Ode on a Grecian Urn. The eternal struggle created the evolutionary advances that enabled our kind to put our footprints on the moon. It is still hard to grasp that human beings have walked in another world and actually traveled to the golden orb of light that mankind has gazed up at with wonder for millennia. Could these things have been achieved without the evolutionary struggle for life and dominance that has driven us upward? An argument can surely be made that it is this life and death struggle for evolutionary fitness that produced the beautiful and ultimate forms of love and achievement that in turn give us meaning. The struggle created the beauty in mankind and the glory of its creations, just as a seemingly cruel nature created the stark splendor seen on this mountain that I love. So perhaps up here, surrounded by a magnificent portrait of nature, I'm not in a world very far removed from the human conflicts down below. Most people see the seemingly serene vistas of nature and never guess the war that rages underneath its aesthetic canopy. There are also those who are unaware of the racial and ethnic wars boiling both on and under the surface of humanity. Although we fantasize about the peace-loving nature of human beings, most of human history is a record of tribal, ethnic, or racial war of one kind or another. For instance, the most read book on earth, the Bible, records the bloody history of the conflict between the Israelites and the other peoples of the Middle Eastern region. It tells glorious stories of war and shocking accounts of genocide. Anyone who reads the Old Testament with unbiased eyes will readily discern its dominant theme of racial and ethnic supremacism. There are many blatant expressions of ethnic supremacism. Israelites are a chosen people, chosen by God above all the other peoples of the world. Israelites have a right to rule over other people and are promised that they will someday own and rule over the whole world. Israelites boast of genocide against whole peoples and kingdoms. Israelites are commanded to murder all the people of the lands where they intend to live, and to kill all the people of foreign nations that do not submit themselves in slavery. Israelites are forbidden to make slaves of their own people, but are encouraged to enslave non-Israelites whom they may pass down as slaves to their descendants forever. Israelites are forbidden to intermarry or mix their seed with other peoples. Now the exact verses where I document this can be found in my copy, in my book, Jewish Supremacism. All of these quotations are footnoted clearly, and you can check them for yourselves. Now few people dare to even acknowledge the blatant racial supremacism of the Bible. And those who become aware of the extreme Jewish supremacism in the Old Testament tend to believe that such sentiments are relegated to ancient times and have no influence on the present. Jewish supremacism, however, shows that the powerful ethnocentrism of ancient Judaism has continued to thrive to the modern day, I will offer compelling evidence that Jewish supremacism is alive and well in the 21st century. It has a dramatic and increasing effect on world events. Now, it can also be said that I, as a Christian, revere the same Old Testament books of supremacy. The difference, of course, is that the Christian New Testament represents a profound shift from the old. In place of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, Jesus Christ taught turn the other cheek. In contrast to Jewish supremacism, Christianity offers universal salvation. Judaism bitterly rejected Jesus Christ and has never enjoyed his teachings of love and tolerance. In fact, not only did the Jewish high priests, the Pharisees, pursue the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, these leaders guided their faith in the opposite ideological direction. It can be said that in addition to the crucifixion of Christ's body, they killed his spirit in their own hearts. It would be wrong to hate or persecute present-day Jews because of the role of Jewish leaders in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ 2,000 years ago. But it's important to understand the ideological, religious, and ethnic war born during those times. From the earliest days of Christianity, Jewry became its chief persecutor, for the Pharisees saw the Christian salvation of both Jew and Greek as a threat to their ethnic purity and supremacism. It should be said that Judaism is also diametrically opposed to the Muslim faith, which, like Christianity, has also been interpreted as a universal message. Not only did Jewish supremacists oppose Jesus himself, they mercilessly persecuted his followers, the early Christians. From John 7:13, "Yet for fear of the Jews, no one spake openly of him." And from Thessalonians 2:14-16, "For you suffered like things of your own countrymen as they did from the Jews, who killed both the Lord Jesus and the prophets, and drove us out and displease God and oppose all men." Over the next few centuries, they codified Jewish oral tradition and adopted the Babylonian Talmud as their most important religious text. According to the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, it even supersedes the Torah in authority. As Jesus Christ represents an evolution of greater love and tolerance, the Talmud only intensified the Torah's chauvinism. I will thoroughly document this fact from Jewish texts themselves and through quotes from major Jewish scholars who discussed the Talmud's meaning. The Talmud's unashamed and frequent references to non-Jews as animals and supernal refuse, as well as accounts of boiling their enemies in semen and excrement, are expressions of racial hatred that would have made Hitler blush. I will prove this controversial statement in this book and even show how mainstream Judaic authorities, such as uncensored editions of another major Jewish resource, the Jewish Encyclopedia, confirm the Talmud's hateful anti-Gentile teachings. I will also show that rabid anti-Gentile teachings are still promoted in modern times by many of the largest Jewish publications, such as the most popular Jewish newspaper in the United States, the Jewish Press. More than any other newspaper, it sets the tone of Jewish religious and cultural attitudes. One of its primary religious authorities is Rabbi Simcha Cohen, who has an instructional Dear Abby type of column called Halakhic Questions. Not long ago, Rabbi Cohen instructed his readers that the Talmud denotes Gentiles as animals, as outlined by Talmudic writings from Gemara Kiddushin 68a and Metzia 114b. In another section, he discusses how a Jewish woman is not designated as a prostitute if she has premarital sex with a Jew, but she is a whore if she has any sexual relations with a Gentile, even if she's married to him. Marriage to a Gentile can never be sanctified or condoned. Such a liaison classifies the woman as a zona. Common parlance interprets the term zona to refer to a prostitute. That's from his column. Another major Jewish publication, the Jewish Chronicle, in an article called Some Carefully and Carelessly Chosen Words, reveals that the Jewish word for Gentile woman is the offensive Yiddish word shiksa, meaning whore, from the Hebrew root shagetz, meaning abomination. It also pointed out that a little Gentile girl is called shikselba, meaning little female abomination. Shiksa, the Jewish term for a Gentile woman, from the root word shagetz, meaning abomination or whore, shikselba, a Gentile little girl, meaning little female abomination. Now, how would Jews and the media react if Gentiles casually referred to Jewish women and little girls as Jewish whores and little Jewish whores? What would happen to any politician or entertainer in the world who referred to Jewish women and little girls as Jewish whores? Am I now supposed to be called an anti-Semite because I simply dare to expose such hateful anti-Gentilism proven in the two most influential Jewish newspapers in America? The Talmud's extreme supremacist teachings have certainly been a powerful factor in preventing assimilation of the Jewish people with Christian and Muslim communities. Even though Jews have lived as only a small minority in Gentile nations for more than 3,000 years, major Jewish geneticists and anthropologists proudly assert that Jews have preserved their distinctive genetic identity. I will show how supremacist doctrines of fear and hatred of Gentiles, along with notions of Jewish superiority, are carefully instilled in every generation. Every young Jew learns of the perfidious nature of the Gentiles from Pharaoh to Hitler. They are taught that they are a chosen people above all other people on earth, and perhaps that must be the ultimate expression of ethnic superiority. For those who still want to think Jewish supremacism is a phenomenon of ancient biblical times, read the following words of Dr. Stephen Steinlight, one of the leading Jews in America, who wrote these comments in October of 2001. Steinlight is no minor Jewish figure. He served for 5 years as the Director of National Affairs, Domestic Policy, in the most powerful and respected Jewish organization in the United States, the American Jewish Committee. Steinlight confesses that rampant Jewish supremacism and disloyalty to America that permeates the American Jewish community. And I quote, "I confess it, at least. Like thousands of other typical Jewish kids of my generation, I was reared as a Jewish nationalist, even a quasi-separatist. Every summer, for 2 months, for 10 formative years during my childhood and adolescence, I attended Jewish summer camp. There each morning I saluted a foreign flag, dressed in a uniform reflecting its colors, sang a foreign national anthem, learned a foreign language, learned foreign folk songs and dances, and was taught that Israel was the true homeland. Immigration to Israel was considered the highest virtue, and like many other Jewish teens of my generation, I spent 2 summers working in Israel on a collective farm while I contemplated that possibility. More tacitly and subconsciously, I was taught the superiority of my people to the Gentiles who had oppressed us. We were taught to view non-Jews as untrustworthy outsiders, people from whom sudden gusts of hatred might be anticipated, people less sensitive, intelligent, and moral than ourselves. We were also taught that the lesson of our dark history is that we could rely on no one." If any Gentile politician dared to say that typical Jewish kids are deliberately taught that their real loyalty is not to America but to Israel, and that Jews are superior to Gentiles in intelligence and morals, he would be mercilessly condemned by the media and hounded out of politics as an anti-Semite. Yet this is the stark admission by the former head of National Affairs for the American Jewish Committee. It should be emphasized that Steinlight's words are not from an offhanded or careless conversation, but are his carefully chosen words from a major article he wrote for Jewish consumption called The Jewish Stake in America's changing demographics. This volume will show that the official policies of modern Israel and many of the leading elements of world Jewry still embody radically supremacist sentiments and policies. Organized Jewish elements around the world doggedly pursue their own supremacist agendas, and those agendas frequently conflict with the interests of the host nations in which they live. My assertion that there exists a powerful, cohesive, worldwide Jewish supremacism finds confirmation in evidence mostly provided by the Jewish supremacists themselves. Their supremacist ideology finds clear enunciation in the foundation, structure, and conduct of Israel, a nation unabashedly based on ethnic supremacism. It is a state that has dispossessed, terrorized, and grossly violated the human and civil rights of the Palestinian people. And the next section is what is Jewish supremacism? And for that, you will have to tune in tomorrow. This has been David Duke, and I really enjoy being with you today. I look forward to continuing the introduction to Jewish supremacism on tomorrow's program. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddude.com.